right. Well, thank you for coming. And so this talk will be about audio for video games. I've been working in video games for about 15 years now. I came in from Vancouver, Canada, which is a long ways away. So hopefully you'll come out and visit sometime. It's a nice place as well. So there's a lot of video game development that happens there. Do people know of Electronic Arts? It's a game company, most people?
Yep.
Okay, good. So they have their largest studio in the world there, I think, even though they they had to move on with a few people because they're trying to hit their expectations for earnings. But besides that, as far as I know, it is the largest game studio in the world, and I've worked there several times. So I also work with the university. That's the Emily Carr University of Art and Design in Vancouver, and I teach there from time to time. But primarily I'm a contractor, so I usually work out of my own house. Sometimes I work within the company that I'm doing work for. I'll have the studio there. I try not to work full-time these days, so I try to keep things a little bit more chill, maybe 3 days a week or something like that. Because if you know, video games can take a lot of time to make, and it's the same thing as film. When you're working on a film project, you know, maybe an audio post maybe lasts a few months, whereas for games, if you're working on a game, it can last for many, many months. So a typical sort of AAA title will take about 18 months or so to complete. And so a good number of those months might be what's called crunch time, and that means you might be working at least 10 hours, if not 12 hours, up to 16 hours a day. There was a time that I used to do that. Now I don't do it anymore. I'm getting too old for that. And I don't need to. So these days when people ask me to work crunch time, I'm like, no, that's okay. You can just see me here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So yeah, hopefully what this talk will do, it'll give you an introduction to the way that audio works for games for me. And what we'll do is we'll hold the questions till the end. We'll make it a little bit easier for the translator. And hopefully I don't talk too fast. I have done this before, but at the same time, I like this topic, so when I get excited, I talk faster, and then when I talk faster, it's harder to translate, and then it makes it so that people don't understand me, and so I need to slow down. So I will try to talk slowly. Okay, so this here is a game that I'm working on right now. It's called Retro City Rampage. And part of the reason why I wanted to have this as the title is because it actually... the thing about coming to Brazil is that I thought, well, the games industry here is very small right now, but the interesting thing that could happen with the games industry here is that you could do what we're doing in Canada, is where we actually put some of our own, you know, like our own cities into the game. So this here says $6 coffee. It's actually supposed to be, it's a sort of a joke about Starbucks coffee, if you know Starbucks coffee. It started in Seattle, but Seattle's only 2 hours away from Vancouver. And then there's another one here called Urban Gouge, Fine Foods. There's a local, very high-end store in Vancouver called Urban Fair. And so, anyways, the game creator, Brian Provinciano, he lives downtown, and so he put some of his own stuff into the game. Right, so I think that would be really cool once video games start being made in Brazil, that you actually use content and, you know, obviously Portuguese and things that are part of your lives and put them into the game. I mean, to me, that's really where you start talking about things that are artistic. Okay, so most people coming to a conference and a talk, you know, you're interested in learning things, but of course, it's always nice to learn how to make money. So I'll give an overview of the way that, you know, the sort of situation is for games. So, as it says, the worldwide sales for the weekend sales for Grand Theft Auto 4 were over $500 million. It's a lot of money, so it would be nice to make that money, right? Versus Harry Potter 6, this is basically sort of, as far as I know, the most, the biggest box office opening for weekend sales of basically $0.4 billion, okay? I'm gonna put this entire presentation online, so So it'll be on my website. If I go back here, videogameaudio.com. Hopefully it's fairly easy to remember. I handed out some cards. What I'll do as well is I have a whole bunch more, and maybe when we have our break or at the end of the talk, if you'd like, you can just grab a card and it has it on there, because I know I typically forget things, even when they're sort of easy like that. So this entire presentation will be online, and I also just got a Portuguese version, which is great. So I'll have a look at that, and I should be able to put that online as well. So anytime you see a little superscript like this, where it's got a number in it, then you can click on it and it goes to a link. Okay, same thing with graphics. Typically those are hyperlinked as well. To have more material about where I pulled statistics and stuff from the pages that I talk about. Okay, so yeah, the film industry is still larger than the games industry, you know, because it includes DVD sales, rentals, television rights, you know, the right to use that film like in an airplane or whatever it is. Okay, but this is interesting for Brazil, as well as the growing markets for games or downloads and online. So AAA titles, the titles I've been working on a lot, not so much the independent titles, the typical budget is around $15 million or so. I live in Canada, so for me, Canadian dollars and US dollars are almost exchangeable. On the next slide, I'll have the Brazilian equivalents as well. So hopefully you can do the translation in your head. Halo 3, which was a big game, you know, this was a really big one, so it's obviously more than just $15 million, $55 million. But then you see here they spent like $200 million just on marketing. So, I mean, there must be a lot of people in the room that play games, yeah? Hopefully a few video game players. And the thing that you might not really quite understand when you're a game player is that you might see reports where it's like, oh, there's this great game coming out, oh, it keeps getting delayed. Game's getting delayed, and delayed again, and then it gets canceled, and you're like, oh my goodness, like, why would they ever cancel this game after spending so much money on it? Well, if you look at it, you know, Microsoft is looking at $55 million versus spending $200 million on marketing. So that's the reason why games, if they don't think that they'll sell, they just, that's it, they cut it off, okay? So it's something that you experience in games from time to time. There's a few titles, even within the last year, that I've worked on that have never made it to market. And it sucks because you get paid to work on something and nobody gets to see it and you can't use it because it's someone else's, they own it, all right? So this is another thing that happens when you work in games, all right? So, those are the general statistics for games. Now, game audio salaries. So, U.S. video game industry salary for last year, the average was about $80,000 U.S. And here's the local value. Is this a fair amount of money that you'd like to make that salary? Is that okay? No. Sort of. Okay. So, I don't know. Maybe you're making like many times this. I'm not sure. So sound designers and composers earn an average of, well, it's less than that, you know, $68,000 per year. And then for independent developers, it is much less. They didn't have statistics for audio specifically, but it was $55,000 average per year. Okay? So the independent market is something that's really opening up these days. The two products that I'm working on are both independent games, and I guess I'm lucky enough to be able to afford to make less money than you can look at the statistics over here as well. I mean, I've been working for 15 years, and so if I was an audio director, the value there is about $100,000, so that's even more than this per year. Yeah, unfortunately, these values are hard to read here, but like I say, you can download the talk and have a look at them there. One of the main takeaways from here, this says 3 to 6 years, this is greater than 6 years, and this is less than 3 years, okay? So it seems that there is a good chunk that's actually between 3 and 6 years of experience, and then there's also a lot of people that have been in the industry for a while, and then, you know, there's a fair amount that are just starting out. One of the big discrepancies here, unfortunately, is that this is male, this is female. It's 94% male and 6% female. I talk in universities, and also I used to teach at the Vancouver Film School, and it's sort of the way that it is. It's not balanced these days. So hopefully something will change there. What else can we look at here? I think that's about it from this. It's probably good, but of course, yeah, you can see the things here when you're just starting out. This is 41, this is 68, as it says here, and then it goes up. And then if you're not an audio director, you're averaging, this is 78,000, that's 100,000. So if you're actually leading people on a project, then you're, of course, making more money. Okay, I'll start my timer here. Okay, so let's just have a look at sort of the potential for Brazil. And this is actually something that I did a bit of research on, but I mean, this is my first time in Brazil. This is my second day in Brazil, so I don't pretend to know everything. It's a very complex issue, and it seems that there's a fair problem with trying to get games for the appropriate value, and that's definitely something we can talk about later, because it seems to be something that's in the way of actually having a proper sort of game development economy in Brazil. But as far as talking online, Brazil is the eighth largest global internet audience. It's pretty amazing, out of the world. I mean, obviously you have a large population here, but still, you know, you're looking at France, India, you know, it's barely behind India. And then you've got Brazil, and then we've got Canada here, right? And if you're curious, this comes from a presentation from ComScore. It's like a they collect statistics and whatnot. So the link to that, where this came from, the presentation came from, is available from this download. And then here's the total online hours per visitor per week, either at work or at home in Brazil. That's pretty good, you know, 24 hours, but you can see Canada. I guess there's nothing else to do when it's so cold outside. You just stay inside and watch the internet. So, where I live is actually not that cold. It only snows maybe 2 weeks out of the year. Other places, not exactly the same. So, since 2002, in Brazil, the online audience has doubled every 3 years. So, you can see the growth is exponential, which is really promising if you're looking at being an investor or even being in the industry as a producer. Okay? This was from one particular piece of research, and they publicized some of it, but not the whole thing. You have to pay for the rest of it. But still, the larger sort of bullet points out of here are quite interesting. So Brazil buys over half of Latin American virtual goods market. So this is the total market, right? And Brazil here is at $165 million US per year. Pretty interesting, right? And so if we're looking at Zynga, does anybody know what game Zynga makes? Farmville, yes, and Cityville, and there's another Mafia one as well, right? So they make Facebook games. And the thing with them is that they make 90% of their revenue from virtual goods, all right? And if you look at Zynga's valuation, it's a little bit sort of pretend, but it's currently at $10 billion, right? So privately held, versus EA, who's publicly held, at $7 billion. That's what their valuation is right now, you know, with the number of stocks and the stock price. So Zynga is actually valued at more than Electronic Arts, that's been around for a long time. It makes all these packaged products and whatnot. So you can see that sort of the way of the future might be this idea of getting into virtual goods, and it's already happening in Brazil. You know, so online gaming in Brazil could be very lucrative. This is something that, if you're interested in making games, I don't know, to me it seems like, why not? Obviously, some of you out there might know that there are some barriers in the way, but at the same time, I think it's pretty exciting. Yeah, right. So here's an overview of games versus film. Of course, games are interactive, so if you're playing a car racing game, you're going around a corner, you might turn really sharply, you might apply the gas, you might not apply anything at all, you might put on, you know, the brake really hard, I don't know. There's so many different things that you can do that you can't necessarily. Like, I had, at one point, when I was working at EA, I had one of the managers come up and say, like, well, you know, the car engines don't sound really that realistic. Why can't we just go out and record the sound of a car going around corners and gravel and stuff? And I was like, no, you can't do that. You actually have to simulate the sound for those certain sounds that are really highly dependent on the game state. Okay, so you don't know what the person's going to do. Even in a, you know, role-playing game, they might go down, you know, there's, they can hear that there is a dragon at the other end of the, you know, other side of the door or something, and they're about to open it, and the music's building, and then, oh, no, wait a minute. They're actually going to, like, drop the controller and go and have a sandwich or something. Like, there's even, like, things that are outside of the game that can change the way that the state is that you need to underscore, right? So interactive, it's very hard to know what will happen. In film, I mean, you just scroll ahead, just, you know, there you go, in Final Cut Pro, all right, you know, rewind a little bit, you know, you're working on Pro Tools or Nuendo or whatever, you can, you know what's going to happen. It's linear, right? So the technology in games changes a lot. You know, we're having the 3DS now. It doesn't make a big difference for audio, but the consoles, they change every 3 to 5 years or so. If you're working with PCs, which I've tried to avoid, there's configuration things that change all the time, you know, Windows 7, whatever else that comes out. There's many different things that can change. Of course, there's also the game code, right? A game I'm working on right now, they had an old version of FMOD. It's like the, it's sort of, it's a middleware solution. It's a thing that allows me to put my audio into the game. And they had an old version of it that actually didn't allow you to do undo. So I was like, seeing as I'm the one working on this, I would like to have undo available. So you can upgrade the libraries? Well, it took them like, you know, almost a week because they had all these, you know, other things to do. And also, it wasn't a trivial thing. So the technology, you know, it changes all the time. The time scale here. So the time experience of the game is often longer. You know, we were talking about Farmville. I've actually never played Farmville. Does anybody know what happened? Is there any music? Is there sound design in it all? There's no music, right? I don't see how there could be music. Because if you're playing Farmville, like, I don't know, whatever, either housewives or, you know, bored school kids or even myself, I guess I might play at some point. But I mean, like, you don't, how would you put music into that game where you're going to play it for even in stretches of like 2 or 3 hours a day, when you play it every, you know, whatever, it's something that you play from time to time, it would drive you nuts to have music because it's a downloadable game and there's no way you could really provide, you know, 3 hours of interesting music for a barnyard. So it's better sometimes to not have that, right? Whereas for a film, there's very few films that don't have a soundtrack, right? It's just, the length of the experience is about 1.5 hours. So you know what's going to happen. You know how long it's going to be. You know when people won't be able to listen to it anymore, right? Whereas games have a replay value. And certain RPGs, maybe the whole, you know, if you finish the full quest, maybe that can take like 40 hours up to 60 hours. And then to do all the side quests might even be 2 or 3 times that. So you can see there's a really hard... Like, if you're working, the person making the footsteps for the game, try making footsteps that sound interesting after 60 hours. You know, it's totally different than working in film. Okay? So, creativity, the design is often very flexible, and this is the reason why I like working in games. Usually, when you work in film, you get the final edit locked picture of the film, and you're doing audio post, right? It's post-process. Whereas with games, when you're on salary, often you're working with the game in the design process all the way through. And something that's really neat that happens, I talked to Valve recently. They make Half-Life 2 and Portal 2 and, you know, some really interesting games. And one of the things is that the person that owns the company, Gabe, apparently, you know, being anybody within the company, you can actually just go up to his door and say, like, look, I want to do this, you know. Apparently, you can even be as radical as saying, like, look, I don't want to do audio necessarily on this game. I would rather do something to do with visuals. And you can even ask for that. So the design and your role within the game can be very flexible. And the hierarchy here. When I've worked in film, there's a distinct difference between being somebody that does sound design and being the director, or being the producer even. It can be really hard to be able to talk to these people because they're like, oh no, I'm so busy, I make a lot more money, I don't really need to talk to you, you know, thanks very much. Whereas within games, it tends to be a lot the hierarchy, you know, the people who, you know, basically sort of manage other people, that hierarchy is a lot flatter. So it's a lot easier to talk to people and actually get things done, which I find is a lot more natural because I find that, I don't know, it's life. You know, when I work in business, I want to be able to relax and not feel like people don't value my opinion. Another thing I've found for myself and also for students that have gone through the program that I taught at the Vancouver Film School is that full-time jobs are more likely in games. So with film, I would say you can make more money on contract for a short period of time. But the problem is then the contract is over, right? And then you're unemployed and you're looking for work again. So although you might be lucky and you can make, I don't know, $1,000 a day working in film post, but you might only be working for 4 weeks. Which, I mean, it sounds pretty good, but then the problem is that you might be unemployed for a half year or something. Whereas within games, you know, at Electronic Arts and other places, obviously you can see that you can be making, you know, if you've been in games for a while, up to $80,000 or $90,000 a year, and you don't have to worry about, you know, where your next job is coming from. So it's much easier when you have a family, when you like sleep, to work within a salaried position, okay? All right, so let's just look at, I could have done, sort of, you know, presented on speech, like dialogue for games or for music, but I'll just focus on sound design here. Just saying how it is very similar to film. So on the creative side, you know, you design the sound design, you figure out what style. Is it going to be like, you know, cartoony? Is it going to be sort of retro sound, like more sort of classic, you know, some more synthesis? Are you going to go out and do some recording? How are you going to schedule that? What kind of gear you're going to use? Synthesis, is that something you're going to incorporate into your sound design? How are you going to edit stuff? Are you going to use Nuendo, you know, Pro Tools, or WaveLab, or whatever? Compositing, how you figure out how these various things fit together. And then mastering, how you get it to sound the best on the particular platform you're working for. If you're making a game for the Nintendo DS, the sound design for the sound effects is going to be much different than if you're working on a 360 game, because you're going to have to be worried about the technical limitations a lot more. So on the technical side, you define how the sound reacts to physics, the environment, to select and generate the sounds to trigger. And you also have to figure out if you're going to store them on, you know, like even on the DS, are you going to put them into memory? Are you going to keep them streaming off the cart? Where are you going to put them, right? These are technical things. And then on the production side, you know, you got to figure out how much you're going to spend on purchasing sound libraries, the recording schedule, coding schedule, right? If you're working on a racing game or something like that, how to figure out how you're going to work that for car engines, or if it's a sports game, how are you going to make it so that the crowd reacts appropriately to the gameplay. So design, there's two different ways to sort of view this. Either you can kind of come top down, right? So you have this artistic idea of really what you would love to be able to do. And then you figure out, okay, I want to be able to make, you know, I want to, let's see here. Okay, even on a Nintendo game, I want to be able to make it so that it sounds like, you know, you have a stadium of like 50,000 people or something like that. And I want it to sound really realistic on the Nintendo DS, okay? Well, that's fine, but eventually you have to figure out what the technology is underneath. What you could do the other way around is say like, okay, I have 100 kilobytes of memory, and I want to make some sort of crowd sound with that. And how am I going to do that? Am I going to go out and record sounds? Am I going to use library sounds? Am I going to try and do some like filtered noise, you know, sort of some sort of synthesis? How am I going to do that? Often in games, you kind of go back and forth. So this is a design process, and it's good to actually know that this is something that you should consider, okay? All right, on the technical side, you know, discover the limits of the software and hardware and push them,
All right. This is something, when you work in games, it'll just be something you have to do. And so if you want to make great games, you got to figure out how to expand the software capabilities and design the tools to suit the game. If you're on a schedule where you just don't have enough time to make proper tools, then probably the game is not going to sound as good as it could, right? If you have a little bit of extra time, then you can actually make a really good sounding crowd engine. You can test it out and prototype it, right? And it's good to be able to fight, it's good to know to fight early for resources. One problem that I had when I was working on a DS title is that the Nintendo DS is a handheld console. It uses cartridges, so it doesn't have a lot of memory in it. And the raw, it's a read-only memory off the cartridge. So I was, you know, composing for it. I finished the whole score, except I didn't quite get to do the title piece. And then the company came and they were like, oh yeah, so all these levels and stuff, they've been, you know, we want to fit all this new great stuff into the game, and actually we need to like take away half the songs. I was like, no, like, I, you know, because the thing is that I can't use that material because they've already paid for it. And so the thing that I did is basically say, okay, well, because they were they had basically decided this in the meeting before I even got there. Like, okay, we're going to take your memory space and reduce it by half. So I had to think quite quickly, and I was like, okay, well, the way to do this is either you make it so that the sampling rate's lower, which wouldn't sound that good, or you can increase the compression, which on the DS isn't really an option because the processor is very slow, or you could just make it mono. And so I was like, okay, let's make the music mono. And that was the way that the music ended up being in the game. So it wasn't stereo, which is fine, because a lot of the times you're just hearing it over the speakers anyways, which are only about that far apart. So you're not going to get some amazing stereo imaging anyways. So, yeah, this is something that you're always fighting for storage space and also processing time. So if you're on a newer title for maybe the PlayStation 3, you might be wanting to use like multiple convolution reverbs for all of your, you know, your group outs. And then you might find that the team is like, oh yeah, actually we need that processing power. So then you, instead of being able to use it on, you know, like the dialogue, the music, and the sound effects separately, then you might actually only be able to do that on the master output, which, you know, is probably not exactly what you want to do, or maybe you have to have a floating one that goes between the three, right? So these are all interesting things that you have to figure out on the technical side, because whereas you're working with film, you know, basically you could spend as long as you want and just have stuff grind away, right? And you can like print tracks, all that kind of stuff if your system's slow. So yeah, with games, of course, things can work one day and totally change entirely the next day. The story that I love to tell about this one, I had a friend of mine when we were working on Need for Speed. I was doing the programming for Need for Speed Hot Pursuit 2. And what his job was, he was a sound designer for the engine technology. He had spent over half a year making these engine loops just so that they're all tuned properly. And then we had new technology that came in, or like the whatever, the big bosses came in like, no, that car sound doesn't sound that good. We're going to use this one from this other studio. So he had to re-edit all that stuff. It was basically like, yeah, it pretty much had to start from scratch. So this is something that usually won't happen in film. I mean, you have scenes that will get dropped, even from a locked picture sometimes, but it's very rare that you'll get something that says you need to change everything that you've done up until this point. Okay, so it's exciting, but it can also be very frustrating. Okay, I'll just sort of blaze through this one. Organization. So what are your basic requirements? So, yeah, over-prepare for the worst. Same stuff for film, right? What tools, software, and resources are needed? I'll talk about tools like FMod and WISE. Those are some middleware tools that are just recently becoming more useful. Work closely with the coder, the person actually putting your audio into the game, and the producer, the person that's paying for the entire project and making sure that it's profitable. So within a larger company like Electronic Arts, the producer can actually be kind of like the director, because at EA they're very concerned about making money and losing money and how much money they're spending at any given moment. So the producer is a good person to talk to. So yeah, this is something that's huge here. This is something that, like, even if you don't work in games,
I would recommend, yeah, it sounds weird, but yeah, to always take risks. Because, I don't know, otherwise you're just, I mean, you could be making money, but at the same time, this is something when, people know Randy Tom, right? Big sound designer for games, or hello, and for film. He worked on Scarface, but primarily he works in film. I did, I think, Spider-Man and, like, The Incredibles and all sorts of big films. And the thing, the story that he had was really neat about taking risks, is that you figure it's like, oh, it's Randy Tom, it's like this guy, he's brilliant, always, it's amazing. He produces sound design that's like, you know, comes out like in gold, right? Well, he was like, well, no, actually, it's quite interesting, because sometimes I have directors that come by to my studio while, you know, I haven't finished the sound design, and they listen to it, and quite honestly, it doesn't sound very good. And it's because he's just still working things out. So when he's at the start of a sound design for a film, he'll often just go through and skip through a sound catalog, not look at names at all, but really pick out sounds that he finds are interesting. And then he'll use that as a palette, like a sort of, you know, a source for the sound design. But it's kind of like he's trying to do something new each time he works on a film. So not only does it keep it like interesting for himself, but he'll actually come up, he'll grow as an artist. Like, he'll do something new that he hadn't thought of before. But on the way there, you can make some really bad mistakes that sound really bad, and then they might actually make you even frustrated because you're like, ah, I don't know what I'm doing, all right? So all I'm saying is that when you're working in games, and just audio overall, don't be afraid to make those mistakes. The biggest thing is, start early and make the mistakes at the start. Don't make the mistakes at the end, because then you might not get hired again. Okay, so yes, audio is always last, so be prepared for feature drop, you know, things that, you know, it's like, oh, we're only having 12 instead of 15 levels. No money. I mean, you do get paid, but there have been projects where I've waited for a while to get paid. No time, everybody's tired, and you're right at the end of the project, and no love, nobody cares. Audio is one of those things where it's like, okay, yeah, we got this thing done. All right, everything's done, except we just needed to make some sound. Right? It's just, with people that don't get sound, that's really what they think. You know, I've had producers where it's like, oh, you know, you just need to hook up the audio. Like, the audio is already done, recorded, and it's all just sitting there, and there's these two things. There's the game here, and then there's the audio, just like, you know, like this, I don't know, like grass or something that you just need to pull out of the ground and then, like, stick it into the game. Well, yeah, they don't necessarily get it. I mean, obviously, there's a quote by, you know, George Lucas who says that, you know, audio is a huge percentage of the picture, you know, if not 50%, if not more. I mean, it's the thing that describes what's around you, right? So it's not something I need to discuss here, but it is something when you're working in games, people don't, it's good to realize a lot of people don't understand audio. It's something you can't see. You feel it, but you can't, you know, it's not as obvious as visuals a lot of the time. So it's good to be sensitive to that. Okay, this is just part of process. I'll try to go faster through this one. So when you're working on a game, often they'll have placeholders that don't sound that good. If I'm working on a title, I'll usually record, these days I'm trying to record most of my own stuff, and then I'll also do synthesis as well to really add, so it has a very strong spectral punch to it, rather than trying to EQ things. So I'm much more for, not so much layering, but more compositing, making sounds that go one after the other. So I'll split a sound into the attack, the mid portion, and then the decay portion. And so rather than trying to make a gunshot that sounds good, because I've got 10 gunshots laid over each other, you'll have phasing issues and other things that happen there. It's best to take those 10 gunshot recordings, I think, and find the best attack, middle, and tail that you want, and paste those together. You can get the game to do that in real time, too, which is pretty fun. Okay? So samples are great for gameplay when we know what's going to happen over the length of the sample. So that example that I gave of the car going around the corner, you know, you don't know how long that's going to take. So samples are okay for making little chunks, but they're not so good for making that whole thing. People have tried to synthesize car sounds, and it might happen in the future, There is this technique known as physical modeling, which algorithmically or uses mathematics to generate sounds. That might be a possibility. One of the things that I talk about a lot is granular synthesis, which to me is fun because you take recordings, samples, and then you resynthesize those from little chunks, and you try and you can stretch sounds out, make them go up and down in pitch. It's what happens in you know, Ableton Live when you're changing the pitch of something without changing the length of the playback time.
Okay. So, you know, and then if we're using samples, do we need to just jam it full of samples because we've got, you know, half a gig of memory now? Or do we actually want to make things have a lot of quality? All right. Oh, okay, cool. So what I'll do is I'll show you a little video here of synthesis, sort of example. So Retro City Rampage, it's an independent game that will be out this summer for XBLA. And 95% of the sounds are synthesized just from two pulse waves, a triangle wave, and a noise channel. So it's using, trying not to get excited. It's using the same sound spec as the original Nintendo Entertainment System. Okay? So that's the aesthetic, the artistic idea, goal, you know, visualization, and also the audio sort of feel that we want to get across with the game. So I'm actually using a mod tracker, a module tracker, which looks like this. Instead of the music going left to right, the music sort of scrolls up. I'll show you the tracker as well. I'll give you a little bit of a break just from the PowerPoint here. It's tricky to use it, but it's free, and it's called OpenModPlug. So I've included a link there in the notes. So what I'll do is I'll skip over here, and I'll show you a trailer for the game. So yeah, we're trying to do the audio for a while, so I'll just play it, and then you ride the levels, I guess. So hopefully this works. If not, I'll just rewind it. No big deal. Okay, so this is Retro City Rampage. One make sound for a game like that? Well, I will load up this one here. So this is an OpenModPlug tracker, and I'll just explain a few things first. Like I said, there's a pulse wave, triangle wave, a noise channel, and then sometimes we use sampled sound, but it's a one-bit differential pulse code modulation, which basically means it's a really crappy-sounding sample. So if you've ever played Nintendo games from that era, you know, from the NES days, then you understand. Am I doing okay for the translation speed? It's good so far? Okay, all right. So what happens here is that we've got our notes, and then we've got which instrument it is, and then we've got volume, and then these are effects. In this case, it happens to be pitch bend. So this one here is supposed to simulate the sound of an explosion. So, yeah. So I've got a bit of noise burst at the beginning, then I've got a triangle wave, which is fairly low, down at C3. Okay, and this one here, it bends down, so it's like, boom. And then I've got, well, I guess we'll see what happens here on both of these channels. So I don't know how loud this will be, so I might want to bring the level down a little bit. Okay. Okay, I'll try playing it again. Yeah, okay, there we go.
Okay, so you can see there, what I'm doing is I'm repeating the notes to give a sense of space, like an echo effect. And so there's no effects in here. I actually have to script all of that stuff in. It's sort of like a MIDI kind of echo kind of effect. All right, so that's what's happening with that explosion sound there. Let's see, I'll load up a couple other sounds. I've got lots of these. Oh, there's this one here, which is pretty funny. Has anybody played, what is it called, Duck Hunt? You know, you got the with the gun, right? So what we wanted to do is we wanted to take the dog laughing sound and put it into the game. So here it is. And what I did with this one, which is kind of interesting, is that I actually, I looked at the spectrogram of the sound from the original title. So if I can find that, yes, so here it is. So this is what it looks like. I use WaveLab for doing my sound design. And so what I did here is this is a spectrogram here. So it goes and then it repeats, right? Okay. So this is the dog laughing sound. And so what I did is I actually tried to figure out what notes and the bend values for each one of these lines here, and then I resynthesized that using the ModPlug tracker. Okay. So that's the original one there. And then the recreated one looks like this. So it's not so bad, right? So instead of it being linear, it's a little bit more of a sort of a log kind of bend up there, okay? So this is the kind of detail that, you know, I'm interested in putting into the game, right? There's also other sounds that I did this with. There's a classic cell phone, like the really big cell phone from the 80s, I guess. And I figured out exactly what tones they use for the... There's a section in the game that he's using a telephone, and I used the same tones that they use in an actual phone, like the DTMF tones, so the dual tones. And so you can actually, like, if you decoded them on the other side, you can figure out which, you know, numbers he's pressing, right? So if we have a listen to this, this is supposed to simulate the dog laugh sound from Duck Hunt, right? So. So that's the laughing sound. And so what I'm doing here is that the notes, they go down, and I've also got these guys so that the effect is bending up. And this is all just using the triangle, okay? What I'll do is I'll show you one more sound that I think is kind of funny. It's the sound of people getting run over, getting squished by cars and stuff like that. So yeah, you can see these are all the sounds that I have, so there's a lot of them. These shotgun sounds. What is it called? Dog. Yeah, see, there's the dog laugh sound. Car skid. Yeah, it's over here. Oh man, there's so many of these things. Squishy. It's, oh, pedestrian. It starts with a P. L-M-N-O-P. Pedestrian hit. So we've got a whole bunch of these because you don't want it to sound the same way when you run over some people because it happens a lot. So here's one. Right? So this one's, you know, you've got the impact sound here that's happening with the noise channel. Then you've got the, right, that's happening from the triangle wave. And so here's the impact, right? And then here you've got the, you know, that's sort of like a sort of sad sound. And then you've got the vocalization happening on this channel, right, where it's got a little bit of a bend. And you put all those together, and it sounds like somebody's getting hit by a car. Right? Sure.
The software is
mod plug tracker. Yeah, so module, but like MOD plug tracker. Yeah, and I'll show you one piece of music as well that I've been working on. I've done a fair amount of music for this game as well. There's two other composers. Gosh, there's a lot here. What would be the best to show you? Yeah, that one's pretty fun. But oh, well, I did an electro one here. I think this one's pretty funny. But actually, maybe I'll show you the... what about this one? I should have picked these out ahead of time. Let's see here. Well, this one's kind of fun because it's a. I was trying to simulate a guitar sound, so sort of, I don't know, whatever kind of blues rock typey thing. Whoopsies. Okay, I'll try that.
Oh, there.
So basically I've got the drums playing on these two channels, the noise channel and the sampled sound channel, so it sounds like this. Right, and then I've got the bass on the triangle wave. Oh, I've got the, actually it's a kick drum that I doubled up on there, right? And the lead sound. Some music for the game. I could show you a lot more, but I should probably get back to the presentation. Anything else I should show you for Retro City? Yeah, not really. I mean, like, that's really what I'm working on these days, and I've worked on that game, I guess, about a year and a half or so. Sort of on the other side of things, we've got procedural sound design. So this is where you create audio in real time based on rules and behaviors. Okay, so this is related to what I was talking about with granular synthesis, and I'll show you a little demo of that. I was in London in February for the AES there, and so I showed this. Basically a real-time granulation using pure data, and that's what this thing is here. If people have used pure data before, it's basically like a language, a scripting language, a visual scripting language that allows you to test out audio ideas really quickly. So with the game I'm working on called Vessel, I'm actually making it so that the game spits out parameters in real-time so that I can listen to them using pure data. So this game, I'll show it to you later on, but it basically uses fluid dynamics. And so we have to figure out which parameters we're going to take from the game to make it so that it really drives the sound of the liquid in a really sort of realistic sounding or engaging way, right? And yeah, parametric or procedural sound has been used since the beginning. So parametric just means, you know, parameters, right? Sort of math stuff. You generate it from the mathematics, and it's real time. So the neat thing is that you can make stuff very flexible. So yeah, you can combine samples with synthesis, like I've said before. And if you're generating the sound in real time, then it's good to allow the flexibility of having the layers happen between the real time effects and your generated sound happen in real time so that you don't have something, basically you're not printing the effects into the sound itself. Okay, so with this, let's see what the next slide is. Yeah, no, I'll show you the granulation stuff here. I can't remember if I put it here or not. Yeah, it might be here. So this is, assuming this works, this is what I showed in London a few months ago. As part of a paper presentation. And so the paper, So the poster is available online. Okay, I've got this modulation thing.
The sound that saved a wretch life.
Okay, so what I'll do is I'll explain a little bit here. I'll just jump right in. So with granular synthesis or granulation of sampled sound, this is more granulation rather than synthesis.
The sample there, that's the wave plot, is up at the top there. The yellow bar is the motion through the sample itself. Then each one of these here is an FFT spectrogram. So its higher frequencies are here, lower frequencies down here, and I've got 8 different grains happening at the same time. So what I do is I split the sound into very small chunks. In this case, I think I put them fairly long, like there might be a half second. So I've got a 500 millisecond chunk here for the grains for each one of these. Okay, and those all sort of play end to end. I can change the pitch and the tempo independently. I can pan the grains around in 5.1, so I can pan those around and surround. And I can also do some weird stuff here. So this sounds, it's supposed to be like, this is playing back the granulated signal, but it's supposed to be fairly close to the way that it was recorded, okay? But you can do some, what you can really do is start twisting things around. So with this example, I wanted to show that if you have a repeated vocal sample that, I mean, this one's a sung one. I can load up a speech one, but what happens in games a lot is that you have samples that get repeated, like, hey, over here, hey, over here, hey, over, you know, like, even me saying that is less annoying than hearing the same sample over and over. So what granulation can do is that if you change the tempo, like how fast it moves through the wavetable, without changing the pitch, then you can make it sound like it has a little bit more variation than it would normally have. So your ears get less fatigued with that sound. Okay, so I'll play this back and then I'll just start playing around with the sound. So, okay, let's go. What's this? Here it is.
I once
it's a little hard to see,
was lost, but now I am found.
Okay, so if I pitch it up, you should see the components move up.
But now
okay.
I see.
Oops, wrong way maybe. And I get the chipmunk effect, right? And I can make it move faster. Right. So you can do some really, you know, interesting stuff in real time. And the thing is that this takes almost no processor at all. Like if I bring up the, let's see here, load meter, like this is, well, it's probably doing most of the processing on the graphics actually, so maybe I lied. But granulation is really easy to do. Okay. So let me load in another sample. Speech. So this is my friend Michaela. Okay. So this is a short sample. And I can just do a modulate here by changing the tempo a little bit.
Dense with rusted roots. New wilderness. Clotted. Dense with rusted roots. New wilderness. Clotted. Dense with rusted roots. New wilderness. Clotted.
So the rusted roots. You have to worry about the artifacts.
Clotted. Dense,
always.
Rusted roots, this new wilderness.
So on sibilance, you hear it
dense,
a fair amount.
Rusted roots, this new wilderness.
And then you can also make dense, it so that it does abstract roots, things like just jumping randomly within the waveform.
Dense, with rusted roots,
Right. I think I'll play around with a little bit there. Okay. And this particular patch here, I haven't made the visualization public yet, but you can download this patch and from my website. So it's videogameaudio.com. And play around with it. I need to clean up the code on this side before I make that public. Okay? So these it's an example of parametric audio, or parametric sound design here. Or procedural sound design, as I've explained it over here. Okay, where are we at with there?
Okay, so that was an example, the granulation sound. Okay, with reactive ambience, and I'll show you a little example in Pure Data about this one. What you could do, instead of simply having a stereo or even a 5.1 recording of an ambience, is that you could split it up into several layers using different loops. So a country ambience could consist of frogs, winds, birds, and flies, right? So the reactive ambience could have the frogs and the birds, you know, disappear for a while after a gunshot. Or maybe even just the fact of hearing your footsteps, you know, the birds might disappear, or the frogs might get more sparse, right? So these are things that you could add to a game to make it feel like you're within that world, like to increase the level of immersion, okay? And flies could decrease with wind and vice versa. So let's have a listen to this. I have an example of this one. It's here, PD, okay, yeah. Okay, it takes a bit of time to load up. Right. I came out of your code. And examples. So, procedural ambience. So, like I was saying, if you've got the frogs, you can start those guys up. Those ready to go. Okay, so that's just a loop of, you know, frogs doing their thing. And we can have birds. Right? And you can see that this is a trigger thing. So you can see every time the bird sound gets triggered, it actually just generates a sample, right? Or just triggered. And it just picks that out of a pool of different samples. Alright? And we can add flies. Alright. Because the frogs need to eat something. Right? Okay, and then we can add some wind just for some background sounds. So the thing here that I've added, and this is something that the game would do, is that when I change the volume on the wind, it's inversely proportional to the flies. So the more wind there is, the less flies, the more flies, less wind, right? In this case, it's probably the wind that controls the flies. Okay, so as we put the wind up, you can see the volume level on the flies change there. Now there's no flies left. Go down here. I don't really like that one. Okay, and then if we have a gunshot happening, oh, where's the frogs? I guess the frogs heard it. Oh no, no, they're coming back real fast. And then eventually the birds will come back. And these are things that you can like put into games to make them sort of like, yeah, basically more realistic sounding. It just gives you that sense of connection with the game. Stuff that you do actually has some sort of effect on the game itself. Right. Okay, so that's some procedural ambience there. That one I haven't made public yet because it requires my whole tool behind it. This one, I'll sort of skip over this one, but basically what you could do instead of having these things, you know, related to your, you know, the fact of you making sound, is that you can have ambiences that are dependent on the time of day. So say for you know, a Wild West game, you've got horses, dogs, wolves, and crows. And so the crows and wolves would trigger randomly, you know, more crows during the day and more wolves during the night, right? And then horses would be more present during the day and dogs more present during the morning and early evening hours, okay? And this approach isn't that likely in larger titles, but maybe for handheld games or for, you know, online games, it'd be more likely. Okay, so I'll take a little, well, maybe what I'll do is I'll do questions here, because this is sort of the second half of the talk. How's that? So I think we're about an hour in or so, is that right? Yeah, we're about an hour into it. It's about 5:30. So I'll take some questions, and I guess... do I need a headset for hearing the Portuguese translation being me getting to hear in English? Okay, great, thank you. She's saying if you're going to speak, you need to speak on a microphone. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, English is fine. It helps me. So if you speak in English, it's translated. Yes.
A minha pergunta é, com esse processo de modulação granular, ele ajuda você a poupar processamento, ou melhor, poupar espaço no processamento do game, porque você pode usar apenas um único sample e criar os efeitos no processamento do jogo. Isso foi esse processo que ajudou a tornar os jogos atuais com som mais realísticos, a trilha com instrumentos, enfim, com um sample de instrumentos reais, ao invés de apenas MIDI, etc. e tal. É esse o processo?
Okay, so the question, I'm going to reiterate it because I'm recording, and so the rest of it is in English. Just to say, basically, it's like what the advantage or what the purpose of granulation is, it sounds like. Does it save space? You know, and with modern consoles, we have such great resolution anyways that, you know, granulating the sound actually doesn't help. So what granulation helps with is it is more for the smaller titles, maybe, because, say, for a larger game, you could have 50 different versions of, hey, over here, just recorded as, you know, many different versions. But if you're working, see, I forgot the mic. If you're working with like a Nintendo DS title, then that's a concern. Like, you don't necessarily have that amount of space. I mean, people expect a certain sound quality from that system, but, you know, granulation is good for being able to do things like those really weird transformations that you wouldn't necessarily be able to simulate, you know, at the beginning of, like, when you've got your sound bank, that granulation could do those weird things and not necessarily be used for speech, but I use it a lot for music, where I slow, you know, like, the music, the input, down a long ways, and then make it so that it stretches the sound out, and it creates a very interesting sound. So to be able to do that live, is it has the advantage of being able to follow the game, if you're working with music, say. So in this case, I gave you examples of speech, and also, you know, a sung piece as well, but there are different things that it's good for. But yeah, the main disadvantage of granulation is that it reduces the fidelity. It's not so good with transients. You could hear it on the sibilance, which has high frequency content, that it tends to phase those out because you're overlapping these things that are not in phase. There are ways around that, but it's more complicated for the implementation.
O papel do sound design nos grandes títulos, que você tem a possibilidade de ter muitas versões da mesma frase, ou muitas versões de um efeito sonoro, de um tiro, etc. e tal, fica a cargo dos programadores a interação de quando um tiro é dado dentro de uma igreja ou fora, para escolher qual é o tiro que tem o reverb e qual que não é, ou é uma coisa que o sound design tem que estar em companhia com os programadores? Como que isso funciona no mercado, assim, uma grande empresa?
Okay, so in English, I'll summarize to say that when you're using sound banks, say for a gunshot sound, whose job is it to decide which sound plays? It's of course all recorded by the sound artist. That's what, you know, we're called at Electronic Arts, sound designer. What you want to have happen is have the sound designer have control over that. So they're the ones putting it into banks. But then the tricky thing is how does the game decide which bank to play? So, and it's also can be very difficult as well, to think of all the different possibilities, even when you play the game for many hours. So often it's a balance of figuring out how to, say, maybe not with a better example is maybe say with footsteps, right? Because you have different, you know, boots versus feet, you know, you're like walking over metal, walking over soil, running, turning, landing. There's many different combinations that can come from the physics engine.
So it is the role of the sound designer to fit the appropriate sound to the game, but it is the coder, depending on the sound tools, but sometimes they have more control, which is maybe not a good thing, but hopefully if they have a very good sound engine, the sound designer can design all those things and the coder doesn't need to do anything. But you will still need to talk to the person like this, say the physics coder, to know like, okay, how do we know that we have a sound like this versus a sound like, you know, like a turn sound? Which, I mean, I worked on a boxing game, and the footsteps are really important, but it's also within the physics engine, you don't necessarily know if it's going to be contact or if it's going to be a turn. So we have a lot of problems with that. Yeah. Yes, yeah, so it's very good to talk a lot to the team and say, this is important for sound, can you give us the parameters? Because usually their priority is on visuals.
Oi. Minha pergunta é a seguinte, eu sou jovem pesquisador, estou fazendo minha tese de doutorado sobre áudio adaptativo, adaptive audio. E minha pergunta é a seguinte, se o áudio adaptativo é um caminho, um bom caminho a se seguir no design de games, né, especificamente no, em termos sonoros. E uma outra questão seria se você acha que existe uma relação entre áudio adaptativo, paisagem sonora, soundscape, e situação, situatedness, no sentido talvez de imersão.
Okay, I'll actually need the first part again. Sorry, I didn't quite get the first, but maybe I'll try and do the second question first. So I believe the way to summarize that is to say the level of adaptivity, is it relational to the amount of immersion? And I would say yes, because I think that if things happen in the game that aren't closely tied to the picture, then it doesn't, your brain sees those things. I mean, how many of us have played a game where somebody is talking and then, you know, their mouth keeps moving after the text is over? I mean, we're used to the idea of that with dubbing, but if somebody did that in real life, you know, that's, you know, your brain just goes like it's not real. And if you hear repeated samples exactly the same with speech, it pulls you out of the game. It pulls you out of that environment because you know that that would never, never happen in real life. You know, like it's very unnatural to hear a sound, like it doesn't happen in nature. So your brain is very smart with audio and it just says, okay, it's a video game. So it pulls you out of that level of immersion. If the game is meant to be some sort of, you know, within that kind of simulated environment, you know, like there was a movie, Solaris, the first one, and what they did that was quite interesting with the sound design is that there was this horse that was running, and when they landed on the planet, they saw the horse, but the sound design of the horse was actually not in synchronization with it. So it produces this imaginary world because it separates the visual world with the auditory world, and so it actually creates this two spaces. And so your mind doesn't like being in two spaces at once. It makes you feel unnatural. And so usually when you're trying, if your aim is simulation, then to have immersion, I think the adaptivity is really important. Yeah. So sorry, I didn't answer your first question. Did you want the first question answered too?
Minha primeira questão faz parte dessa segunda também. Se realmente o caminho para estudar o design de áudio para games seria estudar um design adaptativo. Isso é um bom caminho.
Yeah. So I think yes. I think I don't know. I believe that adaptivity it just adds to the depth of the experience. So I think that it's important. But you can see that like with Retro City Rampage, that's not the goal, right? I'm trying to produce something that it's an imaginary, nostalgic sort of feel, but without all the annoying things from the original NES. So we took the aesthetic, but we didn't take the limitations. So
So it depends what your goal is. You know, to me, I think video games can be art, but in general, yeah, if you're doing first-person shooters or other things that are supposed to be like simulation, like war simulation or whatever it is, then, you know, we're sort of stuck in the idea of simulating the real world or simulating even that idea of what those games have been up until this point. So there's certain tropes or certain things that repeat, you know, that you follow those and people understand that as part of the vocabulary of that type of a game. Yeah.
Oi.
Okay, one more question?
Yes. Posso fazer em português?
Yes.
É uma pergunta a respeito do mercado. Talvez você possa responder a respeito do Canadá, ou enfim, do resto do mundo. Eu queria saber a respeito da dos jogos que são feitos, o áudio, ele é sempre feito por uma pessoa dentro da companhia que faz o jogo? Se ele é feito por terceiros, em qual proporção? E também a respeito da música, enfim, que proporção é essa?
Okay, so that was a clear question, and oddly enough, that's exactly what I will be talking about, but at the same time, to answer the question, it's the basically asking, okay, the amount of audio for a game that's produced in-house versus out-of-house. So people on salary versus people on contract. Sometimes you can work on contract and be in a game studio, which I've done a lot of, but usually, yeah, that's the distinction that we use. So for music, a lot of the times, the composer these days is almost 100% contract. You won't have your own studio within a game company and be a person making music. I met one guy at Valve that did that. He was the in-house composer. There used to be one at Radical that's like out of a 500 person company, and they got rid of their full-time composer. Electronic Arts, they used to have full-time composers for each platform. But the reason why that's changed is because the technical requirements for making music for those platforms has been really reduced. So back, you know, when I started, you know, Super Nintendo Entertainment days, you had to use like a MIDI thing, or you had to use like a mod tracker to make the sound for the game. Whereas now you can just use Ableton, and then you export your stems and you put them into maybe Wise, and you can even make the adaptive, like the behavior, separate from the game team. So music is almost 100% contracted. And then there's also a lot of licensing that goes on from record labels and stuff, so like Electronic Arts and whatnot. I got one more. And then for sound design, then a lot of the times the sound design is done within house. So you have people that's their full-time job, it's being a sound designer. But also, because what we were talking about before with your question is that the sound designer has to figure out how the behaviors of those sounds join with the game. Okay, so that's and that is still a very technical process of trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to make the sound of a Ferrari simulated, you know, for the latest Need for Speed? It's not a trivial question. It's quite difficult to do that. And for those people, those companies don't want to let the people that have that knowledge go, so they want to keep them employed. As far as speech, usually it's done by the sound designer as well. But the localization is often out of house. Okay, so it's a big, big, long answer, but you have another question?
Yes. Só querendo, enfim, a respeito da música, então a música geralmente é feita por terceiros, por, enfim, contratados. E tem uma parte dela que pode ser, deve ser adaptativa, né? Deve ser interativa. Então eu queria saber desses estúdios que fazem música para games, quanto que eles entram nessa parte de interação, de áudio adaptativo mesmo, ou eles, enfim, só fazem o pedido do sound designer e o sound designer tem esse controle maior da interatividade.
Okay, this is once again a question that, I mean, I will get there because I have a demonstration of my work that I did when I was working on NBA Jam, But I'll give an overview of the process, and then once we hit that, then you'll see how it got done. So, the way that we worked for NBA Jam is that we had a composer. He gave us his music and stems, same as you would for a film. So it's the separated like groups of the music, so that you've got, you know, percussion, bass, yada yada yada, right? And what I did is that I took those and I remixed them so that it fit the game. Once we had a really good mix, then we had to derive intensities. Low intensity, high intensity. There's more action in the game, less action in the game. And so I made different mixes from that, and then I cut them up into smaller sections for each bar and whatnot, and then I fit those to the game. To me, I think that that's one of the best ways to work, because if I had to do everything from the composition all the way down to the low-level adaptive music design, you know, my head would explode. It's just like, there are so many parameters that you really don't want to think too far down. For people that play live, people play like live music here. Okay, the thing that happens when you play live, I play live electronic from time to time, and one of the things that you're always coming up against is like, I have a full mix of a song, how do I play it live? You know, you don't want to just play a button, but at the same time, you can't play all 16 tracks by yourself, right? So you have to figure out a balance between those two. It's exactly the same way in games. Because what it's doing is it's playing the music live. Except it's the computer that's doing some smart stuff to figure out how to combine those things live. It's like a little bit of artificial intelligence, right? So it's the same thing that, depending on how you play your live music, with, you know, if you do electronic stuff, you might be doing that as well. So if you're really good at that, then you'd actually be a good fit for composing adaptive music for video games. Okay? So I think what I'll do is I'll continue with the presentation. I'll take questions at the end as well, but like I said, I'm going to show some more demos as far as my working style, also a little bit of business stuff. So you can see a contract, like a, you know, typical contract for games, and then maybe there'll be a bit of discussion as far as, you know, what could happen locally. Okay, so I have about 40 minutes left. Do most people want to end on time? Most people want to end on time. Just 40 more minutes. That's best. Okay, so we'll do it that way. If you have more questions after that, either you can email me, or I'm going to be here for the next 2 days, so you can try and track me down and we can have lunch or something like that. So I'll try and keep to the schedule then. Okay, so this here, this is where I have worked a lot. It's Electronic Arts Canada. I've had, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 contracts there. And let's see here. I think my house is like over here. I can bike to work. It's about 20 minutes away. I don't have a car anymore. I got rid of it. So this is phase one. That was the first part. This is the soccer field. This is phase two, which was built later. And then I think this is phase three, which they're actually pulling people back out of here. And I think they're actually maybe renting out that part of it a bit. But who knows? Maybe things will get better. And this here, can anybody guess what this is? I mean, it's not really fair, but I think it's quite funny.
It's a hockey.
Yeah. It looks like it's hockey. That is hockey, which makes sense. And then I think there's actually another one that's next to here, which is actually a beach volleyball court. So you can play beach volleyball at work. Inside of here, there's also like a full gym and all that kind of stuff. You can do yoga, all those kind of things. And then they also have a basketball court inside as well. So you can see lots of money. Alright? And it seems very, very sexy to work here, you know. People drive really nice cars, except for me. Because that's, you know, people that work on the Need for Speed team, they like cars, right? So, the parking lot is underneath. There's lots of parking. And so, yeah, typically come in here, and I've worked sort of in that part, and then sort of in here. The last time when I was working on NBA Jam, I was in that part of the building. So you get your own office, your own room. It typically has no windows because we work in audio, right? So you don't want to have interference from outside, okay? And you get, you know, a nice set of either Mackies or Genelecs as your speakers. You probably get a surround system, which is good. You get your own mixing board. You get your own, like, level meters. You get all the plugins you would ever need for Pro Tools. You get access to Nuendo. Basically, anything that you need, you get access to. Usually, you have two computers. You have a dev kit that works for the 360, the PlayStation 3, sometimes the also the Nintendo Wii. All right, so you get everything that you need. Isn't that great? Yeah, well, the thing is that usually you have to be on salary, which is good because you get stock, but it's not so good because then you have to stay late a lot of the time. Whereas in your own contract, it's easier for you to say, like, no, these are the amount of hours, I'm not gonna work extra. The last contract that I signed where I was working at the company, I said that I was only gonna work 3 days a week, and if you want more than that, it'll cost you an extra 50%. So it's like, if you want me to work a Tuesday, I'm gonna be making my regular plus an extra 50%. Right? Because video game companies, a lot of the times, they don't know how to schedule properly. It's very hard to schedule software because things break. It just happens, right? So I just said, look, if you're going to have me work extra hours, you have to pay for it. Whereas you work here, you're going to be making the same amount if you work there 12 hours a day, if you wait 8 hours a day. But the thing is that, quite honestly, you'll probably get fired if you're only there 8 hours a day, because everybody else is working long hours, okay? I've done that for many years, and I've done it. Or you could work from home. I'm not going to say whose studio this is, but let's just say that, you know, there's a set of, you know, it's okay set of powered speakers. We've got a, you know, a digital mixing board. There's a computer thing there. It's, you know, not a flat screen monitor. And there's a bit of mess, right? It's not totally functional. And it's in the basement, so there's a ski jacket. It's kind of cold, right? So this is the other option, right? Of course, you can have a much nicer home studio, but I can say that most of the work that I do these days, I have a, you know, H4N recorder, and I have my laptop, and I can do like 90% of the work that way. I have a set of like nice Tannoys to be able to hear things properly. I have a set of good like Sennheiser, the HD 650s, which are good headphones. I highly recommend getting good headphones if you want to work in audio, because you have to be able to check things properly. Okay. So, which, you know, you make your choice. Which one do you want to work in? When I've talked to students, a lot of them are like, yeah, as soon as I get out of here, I'm going to have like my own studio. I didn't show a picture of a super nice personal studio, right? But you can have your own studio, you know, a surround system, Genelex all around. You can have like, you know, all the acoustic things, padding, and like, you know, whatever, like three LCD screens, you know, and just have it like everything all like perfect, a massive amount of outboard gear, you know, set of Avalons, all that kind of stuff. But the problem is, okay, if you've ever done audio contracting, especially when you're just starting out, is that you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Okay? And the thing is that if you work at EA, you can screw up really bad, and the worst thing is that you can get fired. Right? But if you work for yourself and you really screw up on a contract, and in the case if you're not incorporated, like if it's not a corporation, they can actually sue you and take all your money, your house, and take away like money from your family. Okay? So you have to be very careful. I have like knock on wood, luckily enough, never had any real problems with business and with money and being sued yet. But at the same time, within the last couple of years, I've become incorporated, so it separates me personally from my business, which is, it's a good thing. As soon as you start making over 20,000 to 30,000 a year from contracts, I would suggest being incorporated. Okay? So
this is the choice. You know, I would say a big company is good to work at the beginning. And I realize that that's not necessarily a possibility within Brazil, but you might be able to move somewhere and work somewhere for a while and then come back, and then you can work from your home and work, you know, telecommute, you know, do it by distance. And the team that I'm working on with Vessel, we have some of our team in Australia. We have another part of the team that's down in Washington State. I'm in Canada. And then the record label that we're negotiating with right now is in London, right? So it's all over the place. So if we get the composer, he's British. Hopefully that'll happen. And so the idea of being able to work out of your own house is becoming more and more, a very good possibility. So these are functional things. How do I get into games? You know, research. Audio sites, student sites. Look at Mix Online. Look at student sites like, I'll show you one. There's a game career guide. Participate in forums, right? The Yahoo forum is really good. It was set up, I think, partly by Charles Deenan. He's one of the bigger sound designers of Electronic Arts. He's worked in games since he was 13. He was the guy that did like audio for Fast and the Furious. He did trailer audio for many, many different trailers. Play games and critique the audio. Like, really listen to what works well with the game and why it works. And usually audio is a big part of the game. When things really work well, the game, you know, like, even if there's not a lot of audio, somebody has spent some time figuring out how to balance the gameplay and the visuals with everything, like the way that it works for audio, okay? It's the same. I've worked a fair amount in dance, and to have music all the time really loud, it's distracting. It doesn't need to be at the front all the time. You know, it's good to have breathing room. You know, you have the dance up front, bring the music up front, dance up front, right? There needs to be a conversation. It needs to breathe. Otherwise, people get bored of saying one thing loud or just having the dance all the time and not being able to hear and not being able to focus on the audio. This is important. Learn tools like WISE and FMOD, okay? I'm not gonna go through that a lot this time around, but I have taught those in class a fair amount. You know, play around. Like, this is actually important. Like, play, have fun with this. You don't have to necessarily program C++, but playing with these things can be really fun. Like, you can just say, I really want to make a system that will generate footsteps that sound like they're switching from walking to running, right? And if you can build that, that's exactly what we do in games, like, all the time. Okay, and start making games. Games are actually not that hard, you know? Right now, we have this big thing of like, oh my goodness, YouTube, it's so huge. Well, why is it so huge? Because it's so easy to make films these days. If you remember, like, even, you know, well, if I remember, even like 20 years ago, the idea of making a film, I mean, you would have to develop the film, have your even like from a Super 8 thing, like, it was a big process. These days, you have like a little camera that can do the whole thing digitally, and it's like broadcast quality, right? It's the same thing with games. Games, like, you can make, you know, I'm not saying that just one person, but maybe two people could make a game like Farmville. You know, the game's not that hard. Not really, at least what I've seen of it. Like, technically, it's not that difficult. You know, Angry Birds. One person could make that game, right? So these days, games, you know, like, you don't have to make, I don't know, say, some really huge, like, you don't have to make Gears of War 3 or something like that. That would be hard to be made by one person. But, you know, these smaller games, like, anybody can make those games. It's just a matter of spending the time, having, you know, putting in the research, having a bit of talent, having a bit of luck. But really, the biggest thing is just pushing and getting it done. Because, you know, if you hear any stories from people that have been successful with games, you know, it wears you down. Like, I know that I saw the post-mortem, the talk about Super Meat Boy. And basically, those guys, they were sick, you know, because they're working 16-hour days for months. And, you know, they don't even have enough time to, like, do their laundry.
you know, or feed themselves properly. It's like, these are things that if you really want to make it, you don't have to be that extreme, but that's what happens with people that really make it in the industry. Okay, and it's the same thing, yeah, like for Minecraft. So here, ModDB, have a look at this. You know, there's postings on here for people that are looking for sound designers, for, you know, people that are composers. Typically, they don't want to pay a lot, but if the mod is, you know, picked up, then you might have someone like Valve saying, like, oh yeah, this game, this, what was it, the Fortress one or Counter-Strike, yeah, that's a, it's a great mod. Come work for us, right? So the leap from working at home on a game and working in a company, it's like, it's not as big as you might think. This is, if you're looking for, if you're like, okay, well, I like the idea of working in games, but I can't necessarily motivate myself to learn all these programs on my own. I need to have a bit of help. Well, here's a whole bunch of schools that are more than willing to take your money and hopefully turn it into something where you will learn what you need to get into the industry, you know? This is something, it's a bit of an advertisement, so sorry, but at the same time, this is something that a friend and I, Gordon Jurdy, and this is me, are starting up, hopefully, well, no, it will be this summer. So it's the School of Video Game Audio. It's an online game audio school. And so what we're hoping to do is basically have a very low cost to entry way of making it so that you can learn the things that you want to learn. If you want to learn FMOD, you can take a, you know, sections on that. If you want to learn WISE, sections on that. We will definitely not be teaching you anything about basic digital audio. The people here, the Synergetic Audio Concepts, that guy is great. You know, schools like that, awesome. So it'd be like, it'd be great, take that one first, and then take our class, you know? So right now, we haven't quite launched the school yet. We'll launch it with a small number of people, and then it'll just grow from there, and we'll see how it continues. The problem that is happening for Gordon and I right now is just that we're working on a lot of games. So we're just sort of busy with making money rather than trying to launch the school. But once it gets happening, yeah, have a look at school.videogameaudio.com, and there's more details there. Or you can ask me about it as well. Okay, and yes, like I was saying, you know, like what I started out with, Retro City Rampage, it is one guy. It's just one guy. It's Brian, you know? I mean, obviously I'm doing the sound design for it. I'm helping him out. There's another two composers. There's one artist, but really, it's one person. And that one person could be anybody in this room. There's no difference if you make the game in Vancouver or if you make it in Sao Paulo, if you make it in Rio, wherever. It doesn't matter, right? So it's one of those things. Anybody can do it, but are you going to be the person that chooses to do it? Okay, so let me have, let's see, where is that here? Yeah, I got one more slide, which is basically just a question slide. And I'm going to go through some of the more of the examples here. I had basically promised NBA Jam, so let's look at a couple things there. Okay, so so for the next section, no photos, please, okay? It's a small group, but I'm going to show you one of the tools that we use at Electronic Arts that it shouldn't... It's been used for a long time, it's just that they don't like their stuff getting out. So I just say, please no photos, and then I'll tell you when you can do photos again. All right. So let's see if this loaded up. Hello. Drive or network connection? Oh, that's funny. I have that on my external drive, which I didn't plug in. It's worth bringing up. Okay, let me try and get this out here. So what I want to do is I want to show a little bit of how the adaptive music was done for that. So I will need to plug in this drive. Okay. Just give me a moment here. High security. This cable. All right. There we Okay. So that should boot up in just a sec, and we should have access to all this good stuff. Okay. None of that. None of that. Okay. Okay, perfect. Okay, so once I said, yeah, like, please, no photos, it's probably blurry enough that it doesn't really make much of a difference, but at the same time, I don't want to run into any problems. So, yeah, it's actually really blurry. That's great. Okay. Let me just zoom in a little bit here so that hopefully we can see some details. Okay, so this here is a tool that's called Pathfinder that we use at Electronic Arts. And your question about how the segments are done, well, what we do is we break the song into different moments. And this was for the classic two-on-two, the first half. The second half music is separate. Here I've got different areas for the adapted music. And here are the sound files that go into those. So if I go to the next page here, what we can actually do is, it's called Pathfinder, is that we can do scripting. And so this is a programmatic way of defining what plays. I spent a lot of time on this. So in NBA Jam, there's this mode called being on fire. So if you, I don't know, if you dunk it, say, three times in a row or whatever, you go on fire. The ball starts going on fire. And so the music will actually change to a different music section, but the music that it changes to will actually be in time. So it finishes the current piece of music, finishes that bar, and then it jumps to the on fire music. And then once the on fire is over, then it finishes that particular bar and then it comes back to where it left off, okay? So this is something that should happen in games more often, but doesn't necessarily happen because you can see it does require a fair amount of technical sort of know-how here. This one here, see, on fire start. One of the things that we need to do is that when you dunk the ball, I actually made it so that the pitch goes burr, like when you dunk, like it actually, it's like a record grab. So what happens is that it's changing the streaming rate while the music is playing on a dunk sound. So if you happen to jump into the on fire start while you're halfway through that, and then you resumed, then what might happen is that the music would play at like super slow, because you forgot to reset the pitch. There's all these different conditions that you have to worry about. So here, what I'm doing is I'm resetting it to basically making the pitch normal again, okay? So that I don't have to run into that problem. Okay, there's all sorts of other things here. Backboard smash, there's different things that happen there. Here, I did this thing of where it does actually gating, so it actually puts the volume up and down, like it almost sounds like the music's kind of falling apart, right? There is all sorts of other things that I did with the scripting for this. Lots. I'll just sort of skip through those. This one here is interesting because it shows how one branches between different pieces. While this, okay, so you see that I've got on the bottom, this is the low intensity music, this is the high intensity music, but the thing is that when you're playing through a section like this, maybe there's a melody line that goes four bars long, and I don't want it to jump off of that. I want it to complete the melody before it goes into the high intensity music, okay? So it will actually finish this before it branches up here, okay? So you can see that there's a lot of different combinations and permutations that can happen with the music. So that's just one example for NBA Jam. I don't think if I gave, yeah, it's doing the same thing. Those ones are pretty much parallel. And then here, okay, what I'll do, well, I'm already running out of time, but what I'll do is I should be able to actually bring this up. Okay, this is my remix of the title track, okay? So you can see, if this was not the remix, then these tracks, these stems, would just be uninterrupted. But you can see that I've changed it a lot, okay? So there's all sorts of different chunks here. I used FL Studio, it's just the tool that I typically use for music because I find it very fast. And so I'll bring this up. Because basically the rest of this thing here is just going through the different remixes that I did, because I was showing this to the rest of the game team and showing them how much you know, I had basically done to the music to make it so that it sounded all nice and good. So I think, well, maybe I'll bring this one up instead. So this, if you've ever played NBA Jam, this is the music that plays in game for the, you know, when you're starting the basic 2-on-2 classic version. Okay, it'll take a bit of time to load up, but hopefully it'll load at some point and won't crash on me. The problem is that I'm really pushing my system, so it does crash from time to time. And I'm just saying that because anytime you know that something might crash, it will always crash when you're showing it to other people. So if we're lucky, it won't happen. Here's some, these are called slicers. So basically it's sort of like, you know, recycle kind of things, or, I mean, there's the same thing that you can do, I'm sure, in like Reason. Here I'm using like, it's like the W or L1 limiter. This one here, I'm actually using various, you can actually do sidechaining by detecting, it's basically like an envelope follower, and I'm using that to modulate other parameters in the mix. So that's what these two things are. This is a delay. So what I'll do is I'll pull up the whole score here, which is here, okay. Right, Kalina Azucar scratches, and I'll try and make it a bit smaller. Okay, yeah, so this is the whole score here, and let's see, can I'll play you a little bit of it, and I don't remember if it starts at low or at high intensity, so. So, one of the things I had to do is I had to rebuild the entire bass line. So this is actually like, I'm taking his stuff and I'm actually slicing every single bass note out so that I can actually spectrally have some sort of control over it. Because there's a real problem with the way that the bass sounded in the original mix. And also, I tried to make things a little bit more varied, so here we've got a bit more of a break. Right? And that's a drum riff that I added underneath there. Okay. Here's the bongo track. There's that. Jump ahead. Just looking for the high intensity. Or sorry. Yeah, the low intensity mix overall. Oh yeah, so here's a break that would be for the low intensity. Like maybe if you, you know, there's, you're just not playing very well, right? The other team's totally dominating you, and you would hear this kind of a thing. And back to the original mix again. There's some horns. This is our pause music, right? And it would just jump right into there without a break. Right? So this is more low intensity music, pause music. So you can see I've built all this stuff from the composer's stem. It's not music that he delivered specifically. And so part of the reason why I needed to do a remix like this is because the composer's time was a lot more valuable than my time. So we couldn't actually pay him enough to do it. So we got the stems, and you know, the cost for me to do it was much less than his. And then the last little chunk I'll show you here is when you go on fire. Okay, so I'll just show you the transition into that. So here's the end piece of music. And now we're going to on fire. On fire. Right? So you can hear the fire. I actually built that in a reactor by hand. Okay, there's the fire sample, and so I cut that all up and used that as input into, I don't know if I'll be able to find it. It has been a while. It was an effect, so it would actually be over in my mix over here. Reactor 5, fire effects. Oh, here it is, reactor 5. And so you can see it looks kind of boring here, but I took an existing synthesizer, and then what I did is I did feedback on a flange and made it so that it really sounded like you had, like you could hear that little sort of rising kind of fire sound, and then I just put a fire sample into it to give that kind of, fiery feel. So sometimes you really have to dig under the hood and do things yourself. So I did this in, distortion, filter, panning. And sort of the funny thing was is that my friend Ricardo, he's the guy that did a lot of the original tracks for NBA Street. And so we reused some of those for NBA Jam. But they couldn't, they didn't have enough budget to bring me back for NBA Jam 2. So last week when I had dinner with him, he was saying like he was having a really hard time figuring out what the heck I did for the fire effect. And I'm like, well, I spent a lot of time on that. So it's probably the reason why it's hard to recreate. So if you do really good work, part of the reason why they want to hire you back is because they don't know how to remake it. So, yeah. Let's see, I'm gonna cram in one last thing because I said I was gonna show you some business stuff. I'll show you a contract. I will show you it's more of a spreadsheet on sort of how we break costs down. This was a friend of mine, Crispin Hands. He worked on various titles. He worked on Company of Heroes. I can't remember what else he's worked on more recently, but unfortunately, I'm going to have to zoom in a bit. Okay. All right. So with this, we're breaking our sounds down per sound effect. So basically, there's a cost per sound, but then what we also do is that we also add for integration time. That's this. In the integration time, the hourly rate is $50 per hour. So this is different, quite different than working with film. With film, usually you have a set day rate, whereas with games, they'll ask you to put together a spreadsheet like this to say what the budget should be, okay? So the rule of thumb that I've been following is about around $50 or so per sound effect. This is like, not footstep sounds. Those would be maybe like $10 a piece or something. But more where they're like SPFX, like dragons or, difficult sounds to make. So between, $10 and $50 per sound effect. And then for music, it's around $1,000 per completed minute. Okay? So you can see here that we've kind of, like for this one here, these ones are easy. They're just crows. So it's easy enough to get a recording of that. Whereas, the ghostly goodness here is a little bit more difficult, so maybe there's a higher cost to that. Monster sounds, those ones aren't too hard. Dogs barking in the distance. And then what we do is we actually do the reverse. And instead of figuring out how much money per hour, we figure out how many hours from the dollar value. So this isn't the way that everybody works. I'm just saying this is the way that I worked on a game called Monster Lab with Crispin. He sort of handed the project off to me. And so this, it's more so that it gives you and I, the producers, an idea of how long you're working on this to get it done, okay? So that worked quite well because otherwise they just look at the dollar value and they don't understand how long it's gonna take you. So it's kind of an interesting way to bill it out. These ones are really low dollar values because all you're doing is you're taking the sounds from the Wii and you're porting them over to the DS. See at the top it says M6 DS, so that's for the Nintendo DS. And it's just for the time that you spend translating and making, basically mastering those sounds for the DS platform. All right? So that's all, what all these ones are for. But you can see that really, you're not making a lot of money, say, off of the actual sound effects, but haha, look at that. It takes time. So $50 an hour, that's an extra good chunk here, right? And that gives the company a better idea of like saying like, okay, you did all the sounds for the week, you just need to plug them into the DS version. Well, no, it costs money, it takes me time to do that, okay? So that's what that one's there for. This was when I was doing music for the game. So there was some, you know, sound effects that needed to get done. And then for the music side, here we had prototype music, so just 5 minutes of music. And like I said, $1,000 per minute of completed music. And this was roughly how long it was going to take me to do that, so that they could say like, oh, 5 minutes of music. Well, geez, it's going to take me like, you know, basically a week and a half. It might not take that long, but it's good to put a number to it. Otherwise, they'll just keep giving you work, and you will not be able to do it. And you will crash, and you'll look bad. So it's much better to say it's going to take you a week and a half than to say, oh, well, if I work really hard, I could get it done in less than a week. No, no, no. Way better, estimate long, and then when it turns out that they go like, oh yeah, you know, halfway through that first week, they say, oh, okay, we changed that. We changed it so that instead of it being like, well, this one's for spirit drums, instead of it being like a tiki sort of theme, it's gonna be a little bit more like Indonesian gamelan. That's gonna change your composition a lot. And I'm not joking, they basically did that, so. You know, and you can't really say like, oh, well, I was halfway through that. I mean, sometimes you can get lucky. Usually it only gets you extra time. It doesn't get you any extra money. They only care that, you know, they're getting their 5 minutes of music once they've decided on it, even if they change their mind. Okay, so I'll take a break there and sort of end with sort of that idea that it does come down to this idea of eventually, yeah, getting paid for your work like this, okay? And to just highlight the idea that, you know, anybody can do this, all right? So here's my contact information. If you don't have a card, feel free, just grab one up at the front. I have a pile here. This is my website. Have a look, videogameaudio.com. If you're interested in the possibility of taking some classes from me, that would be, not exactly sure how they'll be, but if you think that I know what I'm talking about, then, well, I basically got 5 years of curriculum from my previous job that are going to be in there, plus Gordon's, so there'll be a lot of stuff there. And then if you're interested in what I'm doing these days, I don't do Facebook, but I keep my updates on Twitter, so there's that, okay? Sounds good. So we have any final questions that need to be in the audience? If you have questions for me, just talk to me personally. Like, you can talk to me right now. We'll hang out for a bit. The next session is, do we know, in an hour or? Okay, we have plenty of time then. Okay, so what we'll do is I'll chop off the regular presentation here, and if you want to chat, then just come up and we'll chat for a bit. Okay? So,
Oriano.
Thank you.